Hello and welcome to Inside Exercise. I'm Emeritus Professor Glenn McConnell from Victoria University in Australia, and I'm also currently a Danish Diabetes and Endocrine Academy visiting professor at the University of Copenhagen in Denmark. The idea behind Inside Exercise is to bring to you the absolute who's who of exercise research, so exercise physiology, exercise metabolism, and exercise and health. And what I want is for you to get your information from the research experts rather than from influencers. And indeed, today I bring to you Dr. Edward Chambers from Imperial College London. He's an expert on gut microbiota and exercise. So he's shown that fiber ingestion results in production of short-chain fatty acids by the gut microbiota, and they can affect various organ systems, including the skeletal muscle, and potentially affect exercise performance. He's also shown that these short-chain fatty acids can affect appetite. And in very interesting studies, he's shown that if you do carbohydrate ingestion with and without exercise, they can both have effects on your appetite. I found this very interesting. I think you will too, so stick around. Hi, Ed. How are you? Thanks for coming on Inside Exercise. I was amazed to see some of your work. So, to be honest, I hadn't put together who you were, and then it's really interesting. So we'll talk about how you did some of the early sort of classic stuff with swirling carbohydrate around in your mouth, spitting it out and having effects, which is really interesting, which I'd seen that work. But then your more recent stuff with the gut microbiota and affecting muscle metabolism and maybe exercise performance, who knows, we'll talk about that. And short chain fatty acids being broken down in your gut and being put in the blood and all that. So very interesting work.
Thank you so much. Absolute pleasure to be invited on and join such a illustrious list of previous guests you've had on. So I hope I don't let you down.
No, you won't let me down. So we already had a chat a few days ago and it was great. So we already know a bit about what we're going to talk about. But I wonder if we can start off. Obviously, we'll talk about those things I just said then. But why don't you tell us, what is the gut microbiota and why do we need to sort of think about it and why is it important?
Well, I think from a historical perspective, it's always been known that there are these bacteria within the gut. And it was really only sort of 15, 20 years ago that advancement in sort of sequencing technology just allowed researchers to look in more detail, sort of characterize the composition of the gut. And then it was just found that there was lots of these associations with positive or negative health outcomes with the composition of the bacteria and their metabolic activity. So, it's a lot of the work, the majority of the work that I've done myself personally over the last 10 years has been more focused on non-digestible carbohydrates, so dietary fiber, and how they influence both the populations of bacteria that you get in the gut and the metabolites that are produced, so predominantly these short-chain fatty acids, which I believe to be important, both substrate and signaling molecules, and they're having these impacts on host health.
Yes. So as you say, I guess we've always known there's bacteria down there doing things. So vitamin K, that's when I sort of heard about bacteria. But then, as you say, it's become more, but now it's just like all the rage. And I'll ask you later on about all these, probiotics and Yakults and all these things, if they actually do anything or not. But so why don't we talk about, but then I started hearing, things about how many kilograms there are. And why don't you just tell us some of that sort of background?
Well, it is just, when you actually, so there are bacteria within the gut, it's, I think it's when you actually consider the total weight of these bacteria, it really puts it into perspective. So it's sort of estimated that, any sort of adult stands on their weighing scales, it's around about 1.5 to 2 kilos of your total body weight is just the bacteria in your gut. So this doesn't just reside within what we think in terms of the large intestine. It's been becoming more apparent now that these bacteria in different populations exist throughout the GI tract, so all the way from the mouth all the way to the rectum. So which would be having major influences on how food, particularly the food that we consume, how that's actually degraded and the metabolites that are produced.
Yeah, well, that's what I was wondering, because I was kind of assuming it was the large intestine, because that's what you hear about, vitamin K and things like that. So then I was thinking, well, I guess they wouldn't survive in the stomach because it's like very acidic, pH 2 or something. But then you've got the small intestine. But you're actually saying this, and we know it's in the mouth, right? Because
exactly, yeah. And there's evidence as well that what you actually, the bacteria that you have in the mouth, that's able to actually, obviously, if you swallow this bacteria, it does translocate and actually have an influence on the bacteria that's actually developed further down in the gut. But yeah, you do have the bacteria within the gut. It's very sensitive to different pHs, as you say, different oxygen levels of saturation. So by far the most favorable conditions are in the large intestine, like the colon. But you know, throughout the small intestine, you do have these populations of bacteria. And it's really the biggest difficulty is obviously measuring these bacteria because of its inaccessibility. It's a bit of a black box, really, in terms of how we perhaps get onto in terms of what the novel methods that are emerging to allow you to actually sample from different gastric anatomical sites. So rather than relying on stool samples, which are the classic method to look at gut bacterial composition, but they're thought to really just provide you that snapshot of changes within the colon. And you can't really, from a stool sample, get sort of dynamic sort of changes, perhaps from a postprandial, during a postprandial state, or perhaps in response to acute exercise or in the recovery period, to know how much do things actually change within the gut.
Yeah, so I mean, in the mouth, because you were talking about the whole way through, so I know in the mouth, I've done a bit of nitrate stuff, so people would have heard about, you know, nitrate can get converted to nitrite by the bacteria in the mouth, etc. And actually, that makes me think, because I'm thinking, what order should we go through? Since we're talking about the mouth, what a great segue to talk about, you know, what you did in a previous life, I guess, during your PhD with the mouth swirling stuff. And then we'll spend the rest of the time talking about the gut microbiota. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, so yeah, this was published 2009. So I did my PhD in the University of Birmingham from 2004 with Professor David Jones, who's sadly no longer with us. It was a fantastic opportunity, great following on the work that Jimmy Carter had done with Asker Ukendrup, like suggesting that, you know, particularly some of the benefits of carbohydrate ingestion during these shorter sort of hour bouts of exercise could be coming just from the sensing of carbohydrate within the oral cavity. So yeah, we followed on that work and repeated that observation, and then using functional magnetic resonance imaging, sort of showing that you do get these differences in sort of central reward activity with sort of caloric sweetness compared to these artificial sweeteners that could be providing this mechanism for the improvement in performance, that if you're just from tasting a sugar, that perhaps this is providing this feed forward response to the brain, letting it know that nutrients are on the way in the GI tract. But I think that it was wonderful work to be involved with, but I'm sure anyone who's done these mouth rinse studies knows it's not the most, glamorous of lifestyles, having cyclists spitting next to swirl these and spitting you. So whilst it was exciting, it wasn't something I wanted to necessarily continue in that area. And at the same time, I got interested in the area where sort of exercise and appetite responses, and just became fascinated with sort of human appetite regulation. And a postdoc opportunity came up at Imperial College working with Gary Frost, who I still work with now. And really this went from the digestible carbohydrates in the mouth to non-digestible carbohydrates at the other end of the GI tract. So I really took taking a journey from one end of the GI tract to the other. So really now this, say, focusing on how dietary fibers, these non-digestible carbohydrates, how they can be impacting human health.
Yes. Now, before we get away, because I did a whole bunch of stuff, my PhD even was carbohydrate ingestion and looking at metabolism and things like that and performance. Before I let you go with that, just got a few thoughts, because we literally were doing like carbohydrate ingestion during prolonged exercise, you know, the classic sort of coil, you know, time to exhaustion and over 3 hours and trained and untrained and biopsies and whatever. But then we also, when I finished my PhD, I thought, what about shorter stuff? So we did an hour, and we were one of the ones that didn't really find the effect of carbohydrate ingestion on performance over an hour. But then other people did, and it was like this, all this talk about how the hours are cut off and some find it and some don't and whatever. And then it makes you think, hang on a minute, but if they're getting these reward centers, obviously my people were drinking it and squatting it and everything. Yeah. I guess we're not saying that they don't get anything from the carbohydrate. I guess it depends how long you go. But they're getting, so why, in theory then, because we generally say like an hour is a cutoff, but in theory, if they're getting this reward, right, wouldn't you think it would help them over like 20 minutes even, but it doesn't.
No, they might, well, from memory, if I say from memory from my own studies, from where you tracked the changes in power output from the cyclists over the sort of hour time trial, the effects did become apparent of 30 minutes to, you know, onwards. So perhaps there is a, you know, there is a time frame where there is no effect. But yeah, but I think looking back after we had the chat a few days ago, look back on the papers in that area, and I do think the other paper that's most fascinating that Jimmy Carter and Asker did was the showing no effect where you infuse the carbohydrate directly in the circulation. And again, that didn't really get, obviously it's got sites, but that's just fascinating to me in terms of, so if you completely avoid the GI tract and all the signals and, you know, neural signaling and hormones that would possibly be released from a carbohydrate solution, you completely bypass that, you show no effect on performance at all. So yeah, it's whether it's this carbohydrate acting as a signal as well as a substrate that appears to be important.
Wow, that's weird. And I guess they were, I have to admit, I didn't see that paper either. I guess they were, did they do like a placebo? Did they do like one infusion that was, I don't blame you if you don't remember this, but one that was saline, one that was carbohydrate.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So the saline control, there's carbohydrate.
Wow, okay.
So again, it's really just interesting. It's very similar to what, you know, the incretin effect, essentially, that you see with, carbohydrate consumption, that, you know, if you consume carbohydrate orally, you get particularly things like GLP-1 being released, don't see if the carbohydrate's infused. So again, it's really fascinating. But yeah, what is carbohydrate doing in the gut, essentially, beyond providing an energy source?
Well, this is not a setup, but it sounds like it. But I'm back in Copenhagen, so I've been here 2013, 2016, 2019, 2023. And we're actually finishing up and we're writing up a study where we compared a clamp. So we did one legged exercise.
Yeah.
And then waited 4 hours and then did a whole body clamp and looked at glucose uptake into the previous exercise leg and the rested leg. So we had femoral artery and femoral vein catheters in both legs, all sorts of stuff. Fused microbubbles, look at muscle blood flow using contrast lens, ultrasound, all sorts of stuff. But basically, we find higher glucose uptake, especially in the exercise leg, right? Previous exercise leg. But the interstitial glucose drops like crazy, and it's because you've clamped it at 5 millimole. Right. You know, clamp is not normal physiology.
Yeah,
so because
you
clamp it at 5 millimole, you don't get the big increase in glucose delivery. So you've got this insulin stimulating GLUT4 onto the membrane. You're taking out bucket loads of glucose, but you're not delivering enough. So the interstitial glucose in the muscle drops. So we have these probes in the muscle. I'm not talking about continuous glucose monitoring. I'm talking about probes in the muscle. Now we've done exactly what you're probably thinking. We've done a follow-up where we did a meal instead of a clamp. So one legged exercise, and then they had meals instead of the clamp. And we actually get like double the glucose uptake into the leg at the same insulin. And it's because, as you say, you're actually getting, well, this is GLP-1 and stuff, but it's also the fact that you're actually getting an increase in your glucose, which is what happens when you have a meal.
Yeah.
And your interstitial glucose does not drop. So anyway, I know I'm just off on a tangent here, but it fits well with what you're saying as well. So it's really interesting. All right, so we've talked enough about that. Indeed, I've gone off on a tangent. Oh, yeah, but the other thing we talked about the other day, maybe we could just bring it up while we're talking about this, is how when we did our carbohydrate ingestion studies, we had like double tracers. So we're infusing stable isotopic glucose whole body, and then we had a radioactive glucose in the drink. And I was telling you how we could only account, now I did not go back and look it up, I think we only accounted for like 34% or something of the carbohydrate they drank actually showed up in the blood during the 2 hours of exercise. I'm not saying it didn't show up later. And what did you say in response to that, which I hadn't thought about?
Well, it just depending on the intensity of the exercise. I don't know if you can remember, would it be like moderate to high intensity exercise, you are going to have, you know, reductions in gastric emptying and absorption. So it's just how much of this carbohydrate you're consuming is just sitting in the guts. And we know there are these bacteria that are present in the small intestine, and whether you're just providing a substrate, this digestible carbohydrate is actually, rather than be able to be absorbed from the gut lumen, is actually acting as a substrate for the bacteria. So it'd be fascinating to know, how much of these, this carbohydrate that's consumed during exercise, how much is it actually being fermented by bacteria, and are you producing other substrates which could then be absorbed and used by the host? But again, who knows? I don't know if that study's been done, but I'm sure if anyone's got old samples of of a plasma where they provided volunteers with a 13C labeled sports drink during exercise, if you could look at the 13C labeled short chain fatty acids, it would be a fascinating outcome.
There you go. All right, so that introduces us to the short chain fatty acids. So I know you've done these studies, as you say, with fermenting of fiber to short chain fatty acids, and then what affects, how much of that happens, and are we talking about like a tiny amount of, of short chain fatty acids that are produced, or is it quite a lot? And what effects do they have? So I see you've talked about effects on muscle metabolism and maybe even effects. I don't know if you're just hypothesizing, but
it's all very, it's incredibly individual, the response you get. So depending on someone's pre-existing gut microbial composition, so essentially how much saccharolytic bacteria you have, so how much bacteria you have that's able to ferment carbohydrate, that will obviously have an influence on the fermentation potential that can occur in the gut. So you could provide, say, a meal containing 20 grams of fermentable fiber to two people who've got very different gut microbiota composition and get very different levels of short chain fatty acids that are produced. You do get, if you continually provide high levels of fermentable fiber to an individual, your gut adapts over time. So within 2 to 4 days, you will see this increase in the abundance of these saccharolytic bacteria. So I think that when I first started in this research area, that I knew nothing about dietary fiber or non-digestible carbohydrates. I just assumed that they were just, if you consumed fiber, it's a completely inert substance that just passes straight through you. That was my understanding. I just hadn't really appreciated that bacteria within our gut is able to actually, say, ferment these carbohydrates and produce these short chain fatty acids, which are energy substrates. So the sort of textbook number that's sort of given is around about 500 millimoles per day of short chain fatty acid you produce. So if you look at the actual theoretical energy yield from that, it's around about it's about 75 kilocalories a day. So around 3 to 5% of your total energy intake is these short chain fatty acids. So it's a small but appreciable amount of human energy requirements come from this energy yield from the, particularly from the colon.
Can I just say, and will that depend on how much, naturally it'll depend on how much fiber or digest, you could say, are you calling it digestible fiber? What are you calling it?
So this non-digestible. This is the problem. In the literature, there are so many different terms that probably mean the same thing in terms of people use like non-digestible carbohydrate, but so essentially that's just a fiber. Again, people use fermentable carbohydrates or fermentable fibers, and that's just not all fibers are fermentable. You do have certain fibers like wheat bran that is completely inert, so that they are your things that are beneficial for health because they do just improve your laxation, so in terms of keeping the bowel frequency and bowel movements going. And you do have other diet fibers, again, this is going off slightly, that are non-fermentable, but have this gelling properties within the, increase the viscosity of the luminal content. So they're thought to improve health by sort of slowing down the absorption of both carbohydrate, so glucose and fat from the intestine. But again, then you have these fermentable fibers. And again, the more fermentable fiber that you actually consume in your diet, so particularly coming from fruits and vegetables, then you will get a greater amount of short chain fatty acids being produced in your gut.
Okay, so you're saying maybe on average, it's about 70, we're only talking about 75 calories a day, yeah. Is that right? So it's a relatively small amount. But in theory, if you want to be a stickler, you know, you look at the label and it says, well, I know you just said it's not all fiber, it's the fermentable fiber. But if you were a stickler, you could look at the label and say, well, it's probably slightly more than that. It's probably about 3 calories more than that because some of that's going to be fermented. Is that right? And they wouldn't allow for that.
Exactly. And you just don't know as well in terms of, again, individual variability is huge. So it really depending on someone's gut transit time. So if you have a very slow gut transit time, you're going to perhaps absorb a lot more or digest and absorb a lot more carbohydrate than someone who has a quick gastric emptying time. So more of the carbohydrate is going to get down to the lower gut and be available for fermentation. So again, there's many factors that influence how much short chain fatty acids are actually produced.
Okay. And these fermentable fibers you just touched on then, is it fruit? How will we know? Because he said bran is not, but I'm just trying to get a bit of a, is there something on the label where you go, oh, that would be a fermentable fiber? Or is it not really?
Very rarely would you see on any, the ingredient list that, what type of fiber is actually in it and know whether that is a fermentable fiber or not.
But is it fruit? Did you say fruit and vegetables? Is that what you said?
Fruits, vegetables, nuts and seeds, they're your classic, would contain some element of fermentable material.
Right. So, so we've eaten this stuff and some of it's got fermented depending on our own individual gut microbiota, I guess. Yeah. Now, what determines, again, I know it's maybe not what you've looked at, but what determines that? Is it things like how much probiotics and prebiotics and things you eat? Or is it part of it like even nature and, is part of it, what you've inherited from your parents, or is it how many Yakults you knock back?
There is within, if you look, there's been the Human Microbiome Project, provides by far the best evidence for this. So I think there's around, there's about 2,000 different bacterial species, and some of these are known to produce, are known short chain fatty acid producers. There's known to be a gender difference in your microbiome composition. There's big ethnic differences as well, but the biggest influence are these lifestyle factors. So I think the two being, again, diet, what you're actually putting in your gut to actually, what substrates you're exposing these bacteria to allow them to produce these metabolites. And the other one being medication as well, so antibiotic usage. Mm. So obviously if you have a course of antibiotics, that's going to some extent, not completely knock out, but do reduce the number of bacteria that you do have in the gut. And your ability to produce these short chain fatty acids.
Yes. Now, so I remember my mum used to always say, because I was always on antibiotics, I was always like this sickly kid, always coughing. I was always on antibiotics. Yeah. I don't know how she was onto this because I'm 61 and I was a kid, but it was always like, we need to have some yogurt to put back in these bacteria and things. And she was even like, it's amazing to think now because we just don't bother, but she used to put milk in the in a bowl and add a little bit of yogurt and stick it up in this. I remember she'd climb up the ceiling, it was warmer up there, and put a towel over it and make her own yogurt and just keep topping it up, use the bit left over and top it up, put it in the milk again. So that was pretty amazing. What a great mum. Anyway, it wasn't just for my antibiotic stuff, but she was on to all that. Well, maybe I got the timeline wrong somewhere, but definitely. And it was all this talk about acidophilus and whatever in yogurt. Is that still a thing, and do people need to be thinking about You know, yogurt, kimchi, you know, all these fermented things. I imagine it's way too complicated because, you know, you just said there's 2,000 different species. How do you know, oh, this kimchi's got the one that I need because I took antibiotics yesterday or something?
Exactly. It's very, very complicated. But going back to child, like this is, it's a massive area in terms of this establishing a, say, healthy gut microbiome in, you know, when you are young. So it's obviously known that the two biggest factors there are the mode of delivery. So cesarean delivery versus vaginal delivery has a massive influence. And again, the other big influence being if you're breastfed or bottle fed. So what's really interesting, the studies that are coming out now in that area are identifying that the amount of fiber that's actually in breast milk. So these human oligosaccharides, that these human, say, that fibers that are actually in breast milk. So there's been some work done by the manufacturers of bottle feed to actually try and mimic this levels of fiber in bottle feed. And again, it shows considerable impacts on establishing the microbiome that you get in those early years, which seems to be very, very important.
So it's important to be born vaginally, so naturally, yeah. And also to be breastfed.
Yeah.
To get the does that then set you up for later, or is it just a good start sort of thing?
Exactly, it's a good start. But I think that what we're identifying is if those factors haven't occurred, what can we actually do to essentially boost that the child up to to make sure that they are exposed to the conditions that would help support a healthy gut microbiome.
Right, and then if you have bacteria, I guess, you know, throughout your antibiotics throughout your life, is it a good idea to then, you know, after you've had the antibiotics or while you're having them, to sort of try and get, and this is, again, I don't know anything about this stuff, so what would you go, oh, let's hoe into some yogurt, or let's get some kimchi? And
it's an ongoing area of research, really. It's particularly that period of post, as you said, once you've come off the antibiotics, what's the most appropriate diet to reestablish your gut microbiome? And again, are there various supplements? Are there certain pre or post probiotics that are would be most beneficial to get your, to get really allow that recovery of the gut microbiome as quickly as possible?
All right. And these short chain fatty acids, how short are they? And then tell me what do they do? So let's assume we've kind of been getting there now. I think I could take you off on a tangent again.
That's all right.
So you had your meal. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
So you have your meal, you get the amount of the fermentable material in it is fermented, and you obviously produce these short chain fatty acids as your major metabolic end product. So the classic or the most abundant short chain fatty acids are acetate, propionate, and butyrate. So that's C2, C3, and C4. There are other short chain fatty acids up to C8, I think, but they are produced in a lot lower levels compared to acetate, propionate, and butyrate. So when people say short chain fatty acids, I think predominantly they're the three that they're talking about.
You say C2, so it's two carbons, just so people know. So when you have glucose, for example, it's six carbons.
Exactly.
And then fatty acids are generally 16 carbons or 18 carbons. There are the monosaturates and the, you know, that are 22 carbons and things, but we normally talk about, when we talk about fatty acid oxidation, we're talking about the 16 fatty acids, the 18 fatty acids. So you're saying these are 2, 3, and 4, and then maybe some 6. Is that what you said? Maybe some,
yeah, six. Like up to sort of C6 to C8. I can't remember because it's not something that I look at. We focus on those three predominantly. And it's, as you say, because they're these short chain, they are very versatile metabolites. So once they are produced in the gut lumen, they are rapidly taken up. The vast majority of butyrate is used by colonocytes as an energy source. So that's one of the reasons that sort of high fiber diets or high short chain fatty acid production is good for health. It's because you're providing more of a preferred energy substrate for your colonocyte to actually remain healthy.
Sites are cells, so are cells in the colon, is that what you're saying?
Essentially, that's all.
So in the colon, so you're not talking about ones that have got in the blood and all that, you're talking about ones that it's just stayed there and it's been an energy source for those colon cells. Yeah?
Exactly. So again, it's just there's very nice work done just showing that fiber intake in particularly and levels of short chain fatty acids being associated with gut health, and thinking that butyrate is the key short chain fatty acid in that process. But then you have the remaining butyrate and acetate and propionate. A lot of that gets extracted by the liver first of all. So acetate can be used, it can be directly oxidized by the liver, or it can be used as a lipogenic precursor. And propionate itself is actually as a C3 metabolite, that's actually gluconeogenic. So you can actually produce glucose from propionate. So again, they are not just as substrates themselves, they can act as precursors for other important metabolites. Okay. And then the remainder that then doesn't get used by the liver can then enter the peripheral circulation and get used by other organ sites, in like such as skeletal muscle.
Okay, so just to just keep in mind that there's sometimes a bit of a broader audience. So gluconeogenesis, so you're saying some of the short chain fatty acids can be involved in gluconeogenesis, which basically is genesis of new glucose. So there can be these two carbons, three carbons, four carbons can be put together to make the six carbon glucose that goes in the blood, maintains your glucose levels. And then you said lipogenic, so that's generating lipo, which is fat. So can be involved in producing fats in the liver to be either used by the liver or pumped out to be used elsewhere in the body.
Exactly. Yes. And again, acetate as well is used, can be used for ketone body synthesis as well. So again, they can just be recycled and convert. So it's important to, when you're thinking of short chain fatty acids, that they don't just stay as those short chain fatty acids. They are used as building blocks for other important metabolites. As well, and this has been known for decades that, you know, we produce these short chain fatty acids, but it was around 2002, around that time, it was identified that there were these novel G protein couple receptors, so basically just receptors throughout which were expressed throughout the body, which no one knew what they were receptors for, and it was just found that they were receptors for short chain fatty acids. So as well as acting as these energy substrates, what's sort of shown as well is that these short chain fatty acids signal via these G protein coupled receptors, so GPR41 and GPR43 they are called. So we've looked at that. A lot of the work that I initially did at Imperial was looking at how these short chain fatty acids signal on the short chain fatty acid receptors in the L cell in the gut, which actually secretes these appetite suppressive hormones. So that's what we were looking at in terms of perhaps one of the reasons why high fiber diets are good for you is that you're producing these short chain fatty acids, and via stimulating this short chain fatty acid receptor in the gut, you get more release of these appetite suppressive hormones and people feel less hungry.
Okay. All right. So that's an interesting one. The appetite, we kind of talked beforehand, there's two bits to this. There's the effect on metabolism in the muscle, for example.
Yeah.
And, you know, this sort of almost like an energy substrate side to it, as well as the producing fats, et cetera. But there's also the appetite part. Maybe we'll get back to the appetite part later.
Yeah, because I think I was going to say the whole energy substrate area is particularly fascinating in terms of the work that's been done in rodent models, linking that with endurance performance. So there's been studies done, say, in rodent models, where particularly what they've done is taken sort of normal sort of wild type mice compared to those given antibiotics to sort of knock out short chain fatty acid production. And what you see in these experiments consistently is that these mice have reduced endurance capacity. So, what they studies have also shown is that if you then infuse the short chain fatty acids perhaps into the circulation at a rate that matches what would be produced in the gut, you can then restore that exercise performance. But I'm not aware of any studies that have been able to translate this into humans so far, but there is definite evidence from rodent models that the short chain fatty acid producing capacity from the gut seems to be linked with endurance performance.
Wow, that's very interesting. I know we talked a few days ago when we talked, you were saying that, and you kind of touched on it there maybe, the translation of some of the rodent studies to humans. So I guess that makes me think, because we know that rats, and I think mice, they rely more on sort of extracellular. So, you know, we rely a lot on, you know, our muscle glycogen is really important, yeah, obviously, and we've got intramuscular fats as well. The rodents tend to rely more on extracellular, so the fatty acids in the blood and the glucose. And indeed, you can if you fast a rat or a mouse, they're actually exercise longer to endurance than if you don't fast them, because they've got all this fatty acids in the blood and all this, and they can just use it that doesn't happen for us. So I wonder if, because you wouldn't think that these short chain fatty acids would be that important, you know,
exactly.
If you're saying about small amounts, small calories, compared to just your normal long chain fatty acids.
Exactly. I'm skeptical, shall we say, of the translational potential of this. I think, first of all, you touched on it in terms of there's obvious species differences. So I think in both mice and rats, I think if you look at the size of the colon in terms of its relation to total body weight, it's considerably bigger in rodents compared to humans. So the capacity to produce short chain fatty acids in terms of its potential to influence whole body metabolism is probably a lot greater. So I think I may have mentioned earlier, I think the sort of a textbook sort of amount of short chain fatty acid that's produced per day is around about 500 millimoles. So that sort of, what's that in terms of per hour? I don't know. So even if you say 60 calories a day, that's only what, 2.5 calories an hour, something like that. I think I scribbled down earlier. Mm-hmm. So even if you were able to, you know, a tenfold increase in this during exercise, it's going to be minimal in terms of a drop in the ocean compared to the total energy requirements of the actual exercise.
Yeah, especially how much fat we've got. You know, like even the leanest person has enough fat to go hundreds of hours.
Exactly. Exercise. And it's that whole, how translatable the exercise performance, exercise capacity model in a rodent is to humans. It might be in terms of very, very ultra endurance events where you have more or less depleted your body, you know, or you're running very low on energy sources, that having this extra generation of available substrate coming from fermentation in the gut might be important. But then again, you know, it seems to be, if it's just a matter of just providing extra substrate, why wouldn't you just consume a carbohydrate sports drink? That would just have exactly the same effect. If it's just a matter of getting more substrate coming from the gut, just consume a sports drink. It's going to be a lot easier than getting your bacteria to have to ferment some fiber. But then it goes back to perhaps these short chain fatty acids aren't providing necessarily improving performance through providing a substrate. They're known to the influence they have on skeletal muscle, and it's been shown that they influence glycogen metabolism, and they also increase whole body fat oxidation as well. So again, whether there could be some translation to humans that these short chain fatty acids might affect exercise performance by altering substrate utilization, I think that's an interesting area of future work. But I'm not aware of anyone, as I said, who's actually shown that by, you know, dramatically changing short chain fatty acid levels during exercise, that you get differences in substrate utilization or effects on performance.
especially, I guess, at physiological, because I guess they could infuse a whole bucket load of short chain fatty acids and see, they probably would find something, right? Because you're just pouring in a whole bunch of energy and maybe other bits and pieces as well, as you said, maybe having other bits and pieces effects. But it doesn't mean that's what's happening in real life, as you said, because it's such a small amount. Now, I'm interested, so what did you say there, that the short chain fatty acids may, again, I don't know if this is rodent studies or what, but may affect glycogen, increased glycogen storage, or, and then what effect on muscle, on fat?
It's been shown to particularly acetate, which is the most abundant short chain fatty acid, particularly in the peripheral circulation. There's been work done in a variety actually of species showing that it does affect glucose uptake into muscle. So it does increase, seems to alter the GLUT4 transporter, so ability of the muscle cell to increase glucose uptake. And as well, it appears to have a vasodilatory effect as well on muscle. So it also just increases the blood flow to the muscle, which again would have
At physiological levels, that's kind of surprising, I guess. At physiological levels, or
So that's what's been there's been
increases for what, transpiration and blood flow, so delivery.
And this has been shown mostly actually with vinegar supplementation, because obviously that's a high source of acetic acid. So if you do an OG, an oral glucose tolerance test with vinegar, which must taste vile, you do actually see greater uptake of the ingested carbohydrate. And again, it's just whether that would then could be used as a substrate.
Your
muscle glycogen breakdown, who knows, or even in the post-exercise state actually boost glycogen synthesis. Again, this interesting areas of future work.
Okay, so what about appetite? So actually, before we get to appetite, I want to think some more about, so how quickly do these things, you touched on earlier, how quickly do these things change if you change your diet? Like, do you get a change in your microbiota? And is it different in sort of lean people, obese people, all these sort of questions?
It was thought that it was a quite slow process. So in terms of, it was thought that you once you reached adulthood, you sort of had a sort of stable microbiota, a personalized microbiota depending on your early life, that was relatively stable. And any sort of particularly dietary effect would be quite slow. But there was a study, classic study, was published in Nature it was in 2014. I can't remember the name of the first author, but they did a inpatient study where it was highly controlled, like comparing a sort of a plant-based diet, which was very rich in fiber, versus an animal-based diet, which was very almost depleted in dietary fiber, but obviously very high in animal proteins. And they showed within sort of 24 hours, I think it was only a four-day intervention, but they just really showed how rapid the gut microbiome, in terms of you get the changes in the composition and the metabolites that are produced with the interaction with the microbiota.
So it changes quite rapidly, like so a couple of days or?
Yeah. After a couple of days, you would see dramatic changes.
Okay. And what about these, again, we've touched on this probiotics, prebiotics, yogurts and yogurts and things like that. Do we know, are they likely to have changes, do you know, or has that been looked at very well? And, by conflicted, funding and
obviously that I think it's a varied, shall we say, picture, but there are, particularly related to exercise, there's nice work showing that particular the probiotics, I think the members of, I think it's the lactobacilli family of bacterial taxa, that those in probiotic form seem to, particularly if an athlete's undergoing like prolonged periods of exercise, endurance, repeated bouts of endurance exercise, you do get improvements in immune function. So literally less prevalence of like upper respiratory tract infections. So that's, I think, in terms of with altering sort of bacterial composition through probiotics and exercise. That's the strongest evidence I think that's out there at the moment.
Well, that's interesting. So I had Michael Gleason on a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how if you do a little bit of exercise, you'll get less upper airway infections and things. But if you do a whole bunch, like these full-on, you know, Tour de France cyclists, they'll actually get sicker. But you're saying if they do a whole bunch of exercise and eat probiotics, that will actually reduce the likelihood of getting these upper airway infections.
Yeah, don't hold me to it. It's not a definite, but there's at least evidence that, you know, that from studies that that's in terms of probiotics, you know, altering bacterial composition through changes in specific, you know, increasing intake of particular bacterial species, that's the strongest evidence out there. And it would make sense because these bacteria obviously would have a huge impact on the homeostasis within the gut lumen. And these repeat bouts of, you know, exercise stress are going to place huge demands in the gut. So if you can perhaps prevent that deterioration occurring, perhaps, you know, maintain this gut barrier integrity, then that's going to stop this, you know, translocation of things from the gut lumen entering the systemic circulation, which can have, you know, major implications for health and the development of various infections.
Right. And again, I'm sort of rabbiting on about this, but you think is just fermented probiotic stuff, even though there's 2,000 different species and you don't know what species are in there, is it generally good just to shovel in this stuff? You know, like is, I guess there's no way of telling at the moment, oh, you're actually low on, you know, Acidophilus or something. You should have more Acidophilus or Lactobacillus or whatever you said before. At the moment, well, is it just like it's a good idea to eat fermented sort of products generally? Is that fair to say?
Exactly. I think the thing is, if you've got to think of this from a sort of general population level compared to the athlete population, which is unique. So just going back to general population, this is UK-based data, but this is applicable to any sort of Western country, that the dietary recommendation for fibre is 30 grams per day. And on average, a typical adult's only consuming around about 18 to 20 grams a day. I think it's less than 10% of people eat the recommended amount of fibre. Okay. So at a general level, just eat more fibre. Just Which is...
I've got the wrong end of the stick going on here. I keep talking about shoveling in these bacteria, basically, but not thinking about the fact you need the fibre for the bacteria to ferment.
Right? Exactly. So you can increase the amount of sacrolytic bacteria in your gut by various probiotic approaches, but unless you're providing it with the fibre substrate to do anything with, it's not going to do a lot. You need to create the conditions in the gut lumen for it to produce the short chain fatty acid.
I think you said that about half an hour ago, but yeah, I've got that now. Okay. So I've been talking about shoveling in these probiotics and things, but not talking enough about fiber. So yeah, you need the balance, which
so this is international. This is not, I'm not, you know, I just know the UK based data, but there are, you know, excellent papers out there just showing that, you know, every government agency recommends intake of at least, I think, lowest is about 25 grams a day, up to some countries, I think some Scandinavian countries are up to about 40, which is just impossible to do on a daily basis. But in terms of improving your gut health, the simplest thing you can do is actually eat the recommended amount of fibre. But that's at the population level. But now what you've got to think of it, that's not going to be suitable for an athlete. Or in terms of many athletes, they're going to struggle for two reasons. The major one being that you don't just produce short chain fatty acids, which could be having this beneficial effect. Obviously, fermentation is producing a lot of gas. So many athletes will avoid that, deliberately adopt low fiber diets throughout training and competition because they don't want the potential negative gastric effects of fiber. And the other one being as well, athletes in weight category sports as well, they avoid fiber because particularly these viscous or soluble fibers, they retain a lot of water. So you can actually
gives you weight.
Exactly, it gives you weight. So yeah, I've looked previously in terms of to find compared to the general population, what is the fiber intake of a elite athlete? It's very hard to actually find, but I'd guess it would be low. I'd guess that they don't eat a lot of fiber. Unless they were vegetarian or vegan, then that's a different situation.
Yeah, I was just assuming that on average they'd be eating a lot of carbohydrates, a lot of pasta, and I thought they'd get a decent amount of fiber. But surely there's not that many that are not taking in fiber because they're worried about passing wind.
You look in the literature and it's a huge, like, I think there's this fear, obviously rightly so, fear of gastric distress during competition. So
you're talking about passing wind. You're talking about gastric. So you're saying if you produce a lot of gas from the fiber, it actually makes it more likely to have an upset stomach during exercise, upset.
Exactly. You'd have a huge bloating effect, which could impact your, it's all very well going, fantastic, I've produced these short chain fatty acids, but I'm bent over.
I thought you were talking about they didn't want to pass wind, the baked bean effect.
No, I'm talking about bloating
during the exercise. Okay. It's slow on the uptake today. Okay. The other one was, I'm just wondering, I don't know if people know this even, but lean versus obese people with diabetes, et cetera, do they have different microbiota, et cetera? Again, assuming they're having the same fiber.
That's the problem. It's more or less impossible. Like, you obviously have a different microbiome in obese individuals compared to lean, in various disease states associated with obesity compared to sort of healthy controls. But in those studies, it's impossible to identify what's being driven by the disease or the state compared to what the lifestyle. So we can do these food diaries, in these individuals, but whether they tell you the truth or not is always debatable. So I think the majority of the difference you see is just driven by the excess energy intake in an obese individual.
All right. Okay. So we've talked a lot about the short chain fatty acids and having effects on metabolism and fiber generally. But the other interesting stuff you've done is, appetite we've touched on. So first I saw, it was just a couple of weeks ago, I saw the paper you just had. It was in a nice journal. I think it was it J Physio? I think it was in a nice journal where you had carbohydrate, because I'm always interested in carbohydrate ingestion. So you had carbohydrate ingestion without exercise effects on appetite. So, we haven't talked that much about appetite. And that was really interesting. And also because there's been more and more talk about this lactate, concept that when you exercise, you get lactate, high levels of lactate, and that can inhibit your appetite. So it's a really weird one, because I always think, why do you like really long exercise? I'm totally starved if I don't eat. But the idea, I guess, if you do short exercise, we haven't burned a whole bunch of calories maybe, then your lactate is such, and who knows, the other things you'll talk about can make you not want to eat for a while.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, if you go absolutely nuts, if you're someone with a whole bunch of fast twitch fibers and you do a 30-second sprint, not only will you not want to eat, but you may actually throw up. So there's a whole continuum here. Yeah, why don't you tell us about appetite, exercise, carbohydrate ingestion? It's very interesting.
The work we published recently was, it was really trying to identify the consistent determinants of, associates, shall we say, of both subjective appetite, so how hungry you feel, and what you eat in the post-exercise period in both a fed and fasted state. So a lot of the studies, they control for diet by basically doing the studies in an overnight fasted state, or they'll get the volunteers to consume a standardized breakfast before the exercise. But because of obviously the impact of diet, that's going to have its own independent effects on appetite regulation as well as the exercise. So what we try to do is that if you exercise on its own or exercise having just consumed some carbohydrate. Now, what we found is that by doing NMR metabolite profiling of the plasma samples, you get very different metabolite profile, like in the immediate post-exercise period and then 120 minutes later. But what we wanted to find is what were these consistent determinants?
Sorry. Could you say, so just to get the protocol, so how long do they exercise? What is the intensity? But also the carbohydrate, did they just have it straight before, or do they have a couple of, you know,
This was more of a physiological, so we have to sort of be open and honest, this was more of a physiological study than an actual, probably something that would have direct applicability in terms of in everyday life. So there was a rest and control trial where volunteers just remained rested and consumed water, a rest and carbohydrate, which was 75 grams of maltodextrin, so a standard, same amount as an oral glucose tolerance test, because that had been shown from previous data we had to produce nice robust changes in the plasma metabolite profile. Then we had exercise with water, and then the combination of the two. So we had this nice factorial design where we were able to identify the independent effects of carbohydrate ingestion, the independent effects of exercise, and any interactive effects between the two. And what we sort of found it as related to, so the exercise was 75% VO2 max, a high intensity exercise, but I think it was actually closer to 80% when we actually looked at it. It was, you know, aimed at being 75%, was actually closer to 80%. And then there which is hard.
And for like 30 minutes or how long?
30 minutes. With plasma samples, say, collected immediately post-exercise and then 120 minutes again. And at that time point, the volunteers were provided with a sort of standard, we use like a very large pasta meal where they can eat as much as they want. And what we identified is that GLP-1, the hormone GLP-1, which has these known anorectic effects, that if a volunteer secreted more GLP-1, they also were less, they also consumed less. And we also found the same with succinate as well. So we found these quite large, in that despite all these volunteers exercising at the same relative exercise intensity, we had this variation in how much succinate was appearing in the peripheral circulation. So if you were producing more succinate, you ate less. And again, we have to be, that this is purely association.
Can I just say, can you just clarify, is it correct that GLP-1 increases with so when you have a meal, GLP-1 increases, and you're saying it's an anorectic effect because it's telling you, okay, we've eaten, we don't need to eat more. But does exercise, because I think I saw in your intro, you were thinking maybe it was going to be additive. Does exercise increase GLP-1 as well?
Yeah, exercise increases GLP-1 as well, particularly high intensities of exercise. And again, the actual mechanism of why this occurs isn't very well known. And again, you get these quite large individual variabilities in the response as well. So for some people, you get exercise has this strong appetite suppressive effect, whereas for some individuals like yourself, you say you can do a bout of exercise and feel ravenously hungry afterwards. So again, this was one of the intended outcomes of the work, is to again try and work out, well, what does vary between people, which can explain the impacts that it has on their appetite response to exercise.
Did you get the additive effect just, or was it variable as well? Did you get GLP-1 increasing with exercise? And then
GLP-1, in terms of a statistical analysis, they had independent effects, so which would imply that they are additive. So if you exercise, you have an increase. If you consume carbohydrate, you have an increase. And if you combine the two, then it's based more on the sum of those two, which is interesting. You know, and I think what we're going back to exercise and performance mainly, and as well as perhaps during exercise, how much role is GLP-1 having in terms of if you're consuming carbohydrate during exercise? That GLP-1 is known to have vast effects on the central nervous in terms of central phenin. It has these effects on the appetite sort of feelings, but whether this could be altering the motivation to exercise, who knows?
So tricky. It makes sense, I guess, if you have carbohydrates, it's going to go up and it's going to make you less likely to want to eat. If you have exercise, though, that's interesting, because that goes up, makes you less likely to want to eat. You have carbohydrate plus exercise, it makes you even less likely to want to eat, which makes sense, I guess, because you've had the carbohydrate. But did you have like questionnaires about how hungry are you, or is it just how much they picked out when they got?
So we always had the visual analog scales we use, which are common tools just to measure how hungry people feel. And what's always really interesting is that and this has been found in other studies as well, that there's this dissociation between what people report and how hungry they are to what they actually then eat. Okay. At a buffet meal, the two are not directly correlated. But what we did show is that, going back to what you mentioned with lactate had very strong, in terms of the temporal change in response to exercise and in the post-exercise period, that the levels of lactate did correlate strongly with how hungry people felt.
Okay, so that's that. Yeah, that's maybe I actually, Jonathan Long, I think it is, who's done that lact-free stuff. I've actually vaguely asked if he could come on. I want him to come on, but I've sort of asked for students, and a guy I know is doing a postdoc with him. So that would be interesting to talk about this lact-free business. But the idea is it's the lactate. So your data, even though, as you said, it's associations, would support that. So was that the best correlation or was it more with the GLP-1?
GLP-1, succinate, you said. GLP-1 and succinate were the only two hormones and metabolites that correlated with like the actual food intake response post-exercise. So again, now there's been work done with succinate, so showing that it's produced by the exercised muscle, but you also get succinate produced by the gut microbiome as well. So that's what we're interested in, is whether perhaps individual differences in gut microbiome succinate, is that actually altering what appears in the peripheral circulation and altering the appetite response? So again, we want to try and move this work beyond simple descriptive association and actually see, well, if you actually raise succinate levels in that post-exercise period, does that actually help you? Does that help reduce energy intake and prevent, in some people, that compensatory increase in food intake that you get that can abolish any positive effect on energy balance? But there is, if you look at GLP-1, there is nice evidence to suggest this could be a nice strategy to improve sort of the efficacy of exercise as a sort of weight loss tool. So there was an exercise training study done, so combining the exercise training with a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And again, what they sort of showed is that you got far superior weight loss when you combine the exercise training with the GLP-1 receptor agonist. And that was associated with improved appetite regulation. So again, it's preventing that sort of feeling of ravenous hunger in the post-exercise period. That's what's
that's required. The thing that I'm wondering about, because you're saying your study was suggesting they should be less hungry after exercise than if they hadn't exercised at all.
Yeah.
But then you're saying this ravenously hungry. So you're saying, is it just a short-term period that they're not as hungry? Or are you saying some people, they don't really get that anorexic effect of exercise?
It's highly individual. It's one of those, I'll copy a phrase from John Blundell, and I think it's that with these studies, you lose a lot from just looking at the mean response. The beauty is when you look at the individual responses, that you can get people to do exactly the same bout of exercise, and the perceptions of appetite and hunger afterwards are completely different. And it's what's nice as well, this has been shown to be repeatable as well. So studies have shown that you can, get these individuals and do the exercise bout on 2 or 3 days, and it's consistent. Some people feel really hungry, some people have this suppression of appetite. So again, it's trying to identify, well, what is it about these people that's different? And can we actually, you know, identify what it is, a particular, you know, a biomarker that we can target to actually, yeah, improve the appetite regulation in the post-exercise period?
I guess it's very important, isn't it? For people, because a lot of people that exercise, actually, I had an interesting comment. Someone made a comment on Twitter or YouTube or something, saying that they were pleased that the series of interviews I've done. Often we're not really talking about weight loss. You know, often it's just the effect of exercise per se on things, which is important, because I'd often say to like medical doctors and things, you know, that you guys tend to focus on exercise being good because of weight loss, but exercise itself, you know, will increase insulin sensitivity for 24 to 48 hours, et cetera, without changing weight loss. And that's an important message. Yeah, so I was thinking with you know, a lot of people are obviously exercising because they want to lose weight, you know, or it's part of their strategy, you know, diet and exercise. So I guess it's pretty important to understand what's going on there, because people that are exercising and then don't feel hungry after exercise for a while, naturally that's going to be a better strategy, you know, to try and lose weight than people that exercise and then like eat as much or more because they just starve.
Well, there's fascinating studies out there that have actually, say, reported the individual responses to exercise training. And the best studies are where it's supervised exercise training. So, you know, these people have completed, you know, 12 to 24 weeks of an exercise training program, which, you know, theoretically, if they were to have created that energy deficit with exercise and not compensated for it, you would lose, you know, kilos of body weight. Yet these people gain weight. So exercise is having an effect where it's actually...
Oh, Herman Ponce is going to love you, because I don't know if you know, I had this guy, Herman Ponce, on. And, you know, his big thing is that exercise doesn't really result in weight loss because, you know, it's you reduce your other energy needs, et cetera, to make up for that. And it's really just diet that produces it. So it's kind of a controversial one.
Well, my understanding, and I would say it would be more this individual response on appetite, that some people, it just exercise just creates a state of intense hunger where the actual energy intake that you get in response to doing more exercise is actually having, you know, negative effects in terms of for weight loss. But again, it goes back to whether weight loss itself is, in, you know, you're obviously going to get a whole host of other cardiometabolic benefits from the exercise independent of the weight loss. But as a weight loss tool, I think it's preventing that compensatory increase in appetite that's important.
So despite your study showing that exercise reduces appetite, your overall feeling is that in the long term, you actually eat as much or more.
I think the energy, it's that theoretical energy deficit you create is just threatened because of homeostatic processes that cause, and it's some people, it's not everyone, it's just some people that they just have this rebound effect almost where they will compensate by eating more than what the energy deficit.
So you're saying there's like a yo-yo just within the day, because we know, of course, people do yo-yo when they lose a bunch of weight over, you know, 10 weeks, 12 weeks, 20 weeks, whatever, they'll tend to go back. And Joe Pareto here, I was going to say here in Australia, but I'm in Copenhagen. But Joe Pareto, who is actually a great obesity researcher and actually did our muscle biopsies, he's doing my PhD. Now, he's shown that people lose weight and then their hunger hormones, you know, ghrelin and leptin and things that affect hunger, they just like say, eat until you get back to your original weight. A bit depressing.
Well, so that's why more long term. Going back to that study where they can then combine the exercise training with a GLP-1 receptor agonist to sort of maintain high levels of this appetite suppressing hormone, that showed to be highly effective. So again, are there ways that we can hijack the body, you know, body's hormones and metabolite system in that post-exercise period to really prevent that compensatory response occurring?
Okay, so now just back to I've got some questions on Twitter, and I know you're not actually on Twitter, right?
Yeah. No, I said about 10 years ago, I was going, it was a fad, it will never last.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, like the internet and Bitcoin. Yeah. Yeah. So
Yeah, I don't know how some people find the time. It amazes me. Some
people trust me, I never did it until I started the podcast. Now I find it's really good to get the message out. But also I asked for questions, and I didn't actually fully run on all of them, but I sent a couple. David said, what changes in the gut occur over the course of a grand tour? Pogacar, who ended up getting second, who's won it twice before, was clearly having some gastric issues in this year's Tour de France. So who knows if that's the reason, but any ideas during really high, extremely demanding exercise for 21 days, 21 stages, 23 days, two rest days, any idea what effect that would have? And I guess they're changing their food intake massively as well.
I am not aware of any study that would have looked at, you know, not even elite athletic performance, but, you know, repeated bouts of elite performance and collected repeated stool samples and looked for those levels of changes. But, you know, it'd be fascinating to see whether there is a, you know, a marker in stool in terms of both either compositionally or from metabolite activity that, you know, predicts if someone is going to have that, those GI symptoms that cause them to withdraw. Yeah, but again, it would be really interesting to collect. But yeah,
I actually saw on Twitter that, you know, there's always been talk, you know, like, oh, how much carbohydrate should people have? And, you know, sometimes they talk about 8 to 10 grams per kilogram. Apparently they're having like 18 grams per kilogram or something per day. Just incredible amounts. And then the exercise. So, you know, we talked a bit about exercise, carbohydrate interactions, but I think all of that would go out the window because they don't wait till they're hungry. You know, you'll see they're finished and they're just piling it in for the next stage. I don't think the hunger sort of kicks in anyway.
But that amount of digestible carbohydrate, like, do you reach a saturation point where, like, my thing would be, in some individuals, do you actually break that down through enzyme process and let that become available? Or does a lot of that digestible carbohydrate actually then get further down the gut and start to be fermented? And actually,
maybe that's why they go so quickly. They're producing a lot of hot air out the back.
Yeah, exactly. Just a lot of gas. Are we able to just put that amount of carbohydrate in?
That's amazing. Yeah, I had never heard of or even thought of that sort of level. But it came from one of the dietitians, I think, that's with one of the professional teams. So, and then Angela said M. So M equals mind, muscles, microbiota, and Mediterranean, hoping to be active long term. So I guess, mind. Now, what about, we've touched on this, obviously, with appetite, but what about things like this, you know, microbiota? Every day there's something else that it does. So, again, I don't know. Sorry to throw all this at you. But, you know, anxiety, depression. Do you know much about that? I guess, are these short-chain fatty acids? Well, actually, at first, part of me thinks it's too simple to think there's only short-chain fatty acids that have actually...
Exactly. I'm only mentioning those because they're the things that I research most often. But there's a whole host of metabolites produced by the gut. So secondary bile acids, there's products of protein like fermentation or degradation that are important, and a whole host of immune signals as well. So it's far more complicated than short-chain fatty acids. But
and do we know if these things cross the blood-brain barrier? Do we know? I mean, a few days ago when we talked, you felt like quite a lot of this stuff, it's not as clear-cut as people think, or they've only been shown in animals or whatever. Do you have any idea about that, you know, literally it's like every single thing is affected. But then again, I guess 20 years ago or whatever, we never thought, you know, we thought exercise was just affecting the heart, maybe in the lungs and the muscles. Now we know that there's, you know, things released from the muscle myokines that are affecting like every organ. And, you know, and that we know the liver's talking to the muscle and the muscle's talking to the liver. And you know, it probably wouldn't be that surprising if everything's talking to everything, because we're extremely integrated, but it's very complicated.
Exactly. Well, just what I know is that from the large epidemiological studies that have collected stool samples and looked at microbiota composition, there are links with depression-like symptoms and anxiety. again, it's a lot of it is this associative data. And I think there's a far less randomized controlled trials where people have then tried to manipulate the bacterial species or the metabolites and shown that it has had any effect. So again, it's very hard, like a lot of this area, to move beyond simple association.
Okay. And can we assume even that whatever's getting fermented whatever fiber's been fermented and showing up in the blood or, you know, going taken up by the first pass by the liver or whatever, can we assume that all of it's like good? You know, I assume there's some things that are going to have positive effects, some things going to have negative effects, might even have positive effects in one organ, and it might be having negative effects on your mood. You know, like it's probably, do we even know, like is all fiber and all breaking down fiber a good thing, or is it too simple, or we just don't know yet?
It's probably too simple. It's probably depends on the physiological context as well. Like we did a study a couple of years ago where we took patients with fatty liver disease. So they had a biopsy diagnosis of fatty liver disease. And we gave them inulin, which is a dietary fiber, thinking, oh, if we, you know, increase the short chain fatty acid levels, this will work through liver metabolism and reduce their liver fat levels. And it actually had the opposite effect. So whether in that situation the liver metabolism in these people with fatty liver disease is completely different, and perhaps if you're like providing particularly lots of acetate, which I said is lipogenic, do these people just convert that into more fat?
Yeah.
And again, like, you can't assume that what you'll see in a healthy individual will be the same as someone with a disease state. I think
I guess whenever you give the system something, it has to do something with it. So if you've given it inulin, it goes to the liver and it doesn't actually, it's like, well, thanks, but I don't actually need to pump out more anything. I don't really need to make more fats to pump out somewhere. Yeah. I'll just have to store this as fat.
Yeah, the liver, you know, enzyme machinery in someone with fatty liver disease is probably going to be switched on more to be fat storage than oxidation. So if you're going to provide more of a substrate, it's probably going to store it. That's what we assumed anyway. But it just really just showed that difference between, I think, fiber having more preventative effects than curative, if that makes sense. That might be difference with that.
Now, another paper I saw of yours, which was interesting, and I wonder if we know the cause and effect again, is that higher dietary fiber intake is associated with increased skeletal muscle mass and strength in adults aged 40 and older. Now, my first thought was, is that just because people that have high dietary fiber are maybe more healthy generally, et cetera? Or do you think that's having per se effect?
Again, in that study, we tried our best with the available outcomes that were available to include as many covariates as possible, which could explain it. So every other sort of major macronutrient intake, so particularly things like saturated fat, sugar intake, and also physical activity and sedentary time, were all controlled for. So we are confident, or vaguely confident, it is an independent effect of fiber per se. So once you get to 40 plus, the more fiber you had in your diet, say, was associated with improved appendicular lean mass, and importantly, I think that's what that alone, but we also had the hand grip data as well to show better strength as well. So again, what we're trying to do, this is just one of those bitter researcher moments, we're trying to get work funded to take middle, like, it's very hard to get stuff funded to sort of prevent, we've sort of found, sort of preventative medicine or preventative dietary work or preventative exercise is very difficult to really attract funding. But what we'd like to obviously do is take a group of individuals, particularly with a low fiber diet, and over a course of, say, a prolonged period of time where you might see an appreciable change in muscle mass and strength, actually show it does have a positive effect on muscle mass, or perhaps prevent any further deterioration in muscle mass that you get from ages 40 plus. And again, going back to mechanistically, we think that that most likely explanation for the impact of fiber with muscle mass would be due to the what we think through to this effect of particularly butyrate, this short chain fatty acid, and in terms of perhaps maintaining this gut barrier, so preventing sort of the development of like chronic inflammation, which is particularly coming from the gut, which would have this influence on muscle mass or the mechanism.
Oh, so you think it's the chronic? Ah, so you think it's the okay? So the fermentable fiber is having beneficial effects on these colonocytes, perhaps. You're saying exactly. The cells in the colon, less inflammation, and therefore the whole body inflammation will be less, and whole body inflammation can reduce muscle mass. Is that what you're saying?
That would be our working hypothesis. And after we published that paper, there was it's about three or four independent studies in different cohorts, where they had a control group versus people with low muscle mass. And there was this consistently lower levels of butyrate in the group with the lower muscle mass. So again, it's just tying it back with our own work, whether if you consume more fiber, do you actually maintain this preferred energy source for the gut? And are you just basically, with old age, stopping your gut disintegrating essentially, and basically keeping things in the lumen and stopping that inflammation occurring systemically that would influence muscle mass and other processes?
So for practical takeaway messages here, would you say that as people get older, the fiber, because I know people tend to go, I don't know the data, but people always talk about as people get older, they tend to sort of just drink cups of tea and eat biscuits, things like that.
Well, this is one of the issues with trying to, particularly in older adults, like if you're trying to do an intervention study to get them to eat more fiber, they're not going to do it. They don't want to eat more fiber. As with age, it becomes, they don't want, you get in some people a reduction in appetite anyway. So introducing more foods into the diet, more, particularly things that they struggle to eat in terms of the more high fiber foods that you have in your diet, they take longer to cook. They're sometimes more expensive as well. So basically, there's lots of barriers that stop people eating fiber, which are a lot more commonly reported in older populations. So it is very difficult to actually, particularly in older adult populations, to get them to eat more fiber.
That's a worry. Okay, well, this fits there, therefore, with another Twitter question from Ollie. What, if any, changes occur in the gut with increased age? So I guess you're talking... He's asking about the gut, you're talking about them having less fiber. And do these have implications during exercise and for health? So do you notice the gut itself change with age? Or is it more that just they don't need as much fiber?
The best, I'd recommend Paul O'Toole's work at University of Cork. He's done fantastic work looking at age-related changes in the gut microbiome. So it isn't just dietary changes, say you see with age. Physical activity obviously has an effect. There's increased medication usage, so particularly antibiotics. And again, you just get anatomical and physiological changes with age, particularly reduced like enzyme secretion into the gut. So if you're not producing the enzyme to break down the digestible carbohydrate, it's going to get further down the gut again and actually behave like a fiber, because it's not been digested. And the other important one they identified was social interactions, that we get lots of bacteria just from
picking them
between
up
ourselves. And obviously, if you become older and more socially isolated, there's that less opportunity to actually pass on different bacteria between people. But all of those factors do combine that you do actually see these age-related changes in the gut microbiome, and one of them being the loss of these commensal or beneficial bacterial taxa. So not just short-chain fatty acid producers, but other things as well. And these pathobionts, so these basically bacterial species that can contribute to disease progress in, you know, certain environmental conditions.
Yeah, I just realised, I don't know if we've talked a lot about exercise, but have we actually talked about whether exercise affects the gut microbiome? I don't know if we have.
I don't think we have, but the short answer, yes, it does. So based on stool sample collection, if you know, both acutely and from chronic exercise training studies show that you do get changes in the gut microbiome composition.
Okay. And are these, again, it's complicated, but are these generally thought to be beneficial changes?
Well, from my own perspective, sorry to bring it back to short-chain fatty acids, but you do see increases in short-chain fatty acids. So I can't remember the name of the author, but the best, I think there's one very good paper in terms of the benefit that what that has. It took a group of sedentary individuals, got them to do an exercise training program where they looked at the changes, and then they also collected stool samples after they'd returned back to a sedentary lifestyle, and they showed that these changes did go back. So it was directly related to the actual increased energy load that was occurring.
Okay, and any idea of the time course?
The acute change you get quite, like, particularly if you've done very high intensity exercise. So studies have done where post-marathon or post-Ironman events where they've collected stool samples, and you show dramatic differences compared to like pre-race stool samples. Okay. So yeah, it's a huge effect on the gut. But again, I haven't been able to find physiologically why exercise would alter the bacterial composition. Is it, does it alter pH? Does it alter the oxygen levels of oxygen saturation? Or is it just through changes in the gastric emptying time that then is altering how food is processed, and that you are just getting completely different substrates in parts of the gut that you wouldn't have if you remained sedentary?
That's true, because it's been known forever that when you exercise, you reduce your gastrointestinal tract, motility and how long things take to go through. And you were saying earlier, if you slow that down, you have more time. Ooh, so what would happen there? More time to absorb it, and less will get through to the large intestine, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that would reduce your short chain fatty acids, maybe.
Theoretically, it would, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess there's also all the hormonal changes. Who knows, like, there's adrenaline, cortisol. Actually, you had something about, what was that about? You had something about glucagon. So you get changes in, during exercise, you get increases in glucagon, decreases in insulin, increases in adrenaline, increases in cortisol, depending on intensity and duration. Who knows what effect all these things have.
Well, we became interested in glucagon because we thought it could be a hormone that explained the post-exercise appetite responses, and in particular the individual differences. But we showed no relationship with glucagon release with exercise did have a significant main effect of glucagon, but it wasn't associated at all with any of the appetite responses that we had. And then we did a systematic review and meta-analysis where we looked at what influence glucagon infusions have on energy intake. And there didn't seem to be any consistent impact of glucagon on energy intake, whereas it has these considerable impacts on energy expenditure.
Okay, great. All right, now you mentioned something about sex differences earlier, but I missed it. So I know with your carbohydrate versus exercise, you know, by 2x2 design, that was in men. Now you said something, someone sent a question through, are there sex differences, Angela, with, I guess, the gut microbiome, appetite, do you know? You said something earlier, sorry, I forgot what it was.
There is, again, the Gut Microbiome Project work would be the best source to look at this, but there are gender differences, but I think it's when you look at the percentage explanation, it's minimal when you compare it to other lifestyle factors. And I think it might even be during certain stages of life, particularly where during puberty, where you have these large, considerable differences in sex hormones. And again, in women post-menopause, there appears to be these shifts in the gut microbiome. So again, there are gender differences, but again, the extent of the effect compared to other factors, I don't think is as large. Okay. But don't hold me to that.
All right, so that maybe there is a hormonal, because after, you know, the classic post-menopause is there's estrogen, of course.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about, this is a one, one of the questions I sometimes ask, what are the controversies in the field? There's probably a fair few controversies in this field.
I say it's not really controversies. I think that the gut microbiome has been very guilty into the field of probably overemphasizing its importance, particularly from highly controlled rodent studies showing that, you know, particular species, particular gut metabolites can affect various disease states. But it's always that translation to humans is always incredibly difficult. So any paper that's only been shown in rodent models, always treat with a bit of skepticism until there's any human data to back it up. Again, it's not saying that there's anything, the data within these studies is particularly wrong. It's, we just know that the gut microbiome is so responsive to a whole host of external drivers. So if a rodent study showed that a particular probiotic was highly beneficial, then that might be the case. But if one of us goes out on a Friday night and sinks, you know, 5 or 6 pints, whereas the other one doesn't, that's probably going to have a lot more benefit on the gut microbiome than the, you know, this probiotic. So yeah, it's just lifestyle factors in free living humans are just so difficult to control for their influence on the gut microbiome.
Actually, just that extreme case you there, well, it's not that extreme, 5 or 6 pints, but it made me think of I've been known to eat a lot of chocolate, and you might think, yeah, oh, that's probably going to mess up my microbiome. But then I exercise every day as well. So, you know, do we know those interact? I'm sure they don't know. Like, no one's done a study like eat 200 grams of chocolate plus or minus going for a ride, 2-hour ride afterwards. What happens to your microbiome?
Now, the data is really, again, the field is still in its relative infancy, and particularly like diet and exercise factors, the studies are always really controlled, like in terms of they control for one factor over the other. So if you're looking at the influence of chocolate on the gut microbiome, they would always standardize the amount of exercise participants have had, so to rule that out. And again, I think it's the interactions between the two that are, you know, fascinating. Again, if you have your chocolate and you exercise before or after, how does that influence the, you know, what happens to the gut microbiome?
Funny enough, I just remembered now, we did a study on my PhD and we were doing these different carbohydrates. And it was to do with funding that we actually ended up doing a solid versus liquid because we got money from a chocolate company. So they were eating chocolate during exercise. So it could be before, during, or after exercise.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, I think if we covered, what I like to do towards the end is have a bit of a takeaway messages. Have we covered everything pretty much? Because I almost forgot about exercise per se.
Yeah. So, oh, no, so. I think we've covered, a range of subjects. It's been,
good.
It's been like
so what about some take?
I enjoyed it.
Pardon? What's it?
It's been like a therapy session. I've enjoyed it.
I'm such a calming influence. Yeah. So, okay. So what about some takeaway messages we'd like people to get out of this chat?
My one is always eat more fiber. That's by far, the vast majority of us simply do not eat enough fiber, and encourage, always consider fiber as its influence it could be having. The other take home message is, I think the, something, I think the field of the gut microbiome is moving on. I think that there were a paper published in, I think it was the start of June, where someone has developed these capsules that you ingest that are then able to collect samples from the gut lumen at specific different parts. So because of the changing pH through the gastrointestinal tract, once it gets to a certain pH, it collects, say, I think it's 400 microliters of fluid. So that then, once it's passed out, you're then able to do the microbiome analysis and the metabolite profile as well. And I think that that kind of technology is really going to advance our understanding of the gut microbiome.
eat more fiber. Oh, sorry, that's interesting. But yeah, take away. So eat more fiber. And what about, so exercise looks like it's good.
Yeah.
And probiotics maybe, or, you know, these fermented things. But would you come back to, I mean, exercise is good for you anyway.
Yeah.
But would you basically come back, the main thing is just eat more fiber. Is that right?
That would be mine. Eat more fiber. That's the, eat the recommended amount of fiber. Oh, yeah. And whether either via whole food, if necessary, or if not, there's a range of supplements that are available, which you can add to your commonly ingested food to get that extra 5 to 10 grams per day.
All right. Well, thank you, Ed. Thank you very much for your time.
Yes, it's been a pleasure.
Great. Okay. See you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please like, subscribe, pass it on to your friends and colleagues. Check out the other podcasts. Thanks again.